Case number 24-5065. William Q. Scott, appellant versus Georgetown University Law Center and Department of Education Office for Civil Rights. Mr. Q. Scott for the appellant, Ms. Schuster for the appellees.
Good morning, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The district court's findings that service is defective and that in the alternative, I failed to state a claim are erroneous. Regarding service of process, the district court's findings rely almost entirely on the fact that I filled out the return address field on the envelope that contained the summons and the complaint. The district court relied on this fact to find that I had personally mailed the summons and the complaint. This is despite the fact that I submitted to the court a signed affidavit signed under the penalty of perjury from a third party stating that she had, in fact, mailed the summons and the complaint.
Putting aside the facts of this case, are you willing to accept the general proposition that a plaintiff can't self-serve?
No, Your Honor. The district court relied on the Johnson-Richardson cases for the proposition that a plaintiff may not mail the summons and complaint by himself or herself. The plain text of Federal Rules of Civil Procedure Rule 4 says that service of process can be affected under the local rules, and the local rules in this area are the rules of the DC Superior Court, which permit a plaintiff to mail a summons and a complaint himself.
Which is one option for manner of service under 4E, which seems independent of the who should serve rule, which is 4C.
Correct, Your Honor. And there are, while Georgetown has pointed to Johnson Richardson for the prohibition on a plaintiff mailing a summons and a complaint, there are other cases at the DC district court level where a plaintiff has mailed a summons and complaint, and that service has been recognized as properly served without much analysis or further explanation, because the plain text is clear under Rule 4E, and it's uncontroversial in DC Superior Court that a plaintiff may do so. Because the district court's finding of ineffective service entirely relies on, one, the fact that I filled out the return address field, which in my opinion is completely irrelevant to whether I mailed it or not, which I didn't because there was a third party who submitted a signed affidavit under the penalty of perjury that she did. There's no other finding to support the district court's conclusion that service was not effective. Georgetown alleges that service was not effective because it was not received by an authorized agent or there was not a return receipt. The district court made no findings on either of these arguments raised by Georgetown. Georgetown raised them before the district court twice, and two times the district court said nothing on these two other arguments.
Certainly right, but please.
We can affirm on any ground.
Correct.
So why, suppose we agree with you on your principal point that second time around you had your friend do the service. So you win on that ground. Why shouldn't we affirm on the alternative ground that there was no receipt?
First, the district court made no factual findings whether there was or was not. So as a court of review, my opinion is that there's nothing in the record. There aren't sufficient facts in the record for this court to make that finding. In the alternative that this court does agree with Georgetown,
it's your burden to prove service.
Correct. And there are attachments that I submitted to the district court that I believe meet my burden in on these two other requirements that Georgetown has raised. The district court did not make any findings on that. Even if
what in the record would show that there was receipt and return?
So there is the attached to the service of process affidavit, there is the green certified mail receipt there, filled out in the handwriting of the third party who...
No, I know. I'm giving you that. Okay. I'm focused on the receipt.
And
point.
Also the tracking and everything. I also submitted a screenshot showing it had been delivered. And it's addressed to the Office of the General Counsel. Georgetown claims that their general counsel is not authorized to accept service of process. Even if this court agrees with Georgetown that for those alternative reasons, service was defective, I should be given a further opportunity to affect service. One, because even though Georgetown had raised these arguments twice, the district court never relied on these. And if we are going to look to Johnson Richardson, the pro se plaintiff in Johnson Richardson was given three chances to affect service. Also in Johnson...
You sort of had a third chance. The district court dismissed the second time and the limitations period was still open. You could have reserved.
So my understanding, the district court dismissed in its last order, dismissed
without
it
prejudice.
Without prejudice, but did not give, unlike its prior order, did not give me another opportunity to further affect service. And in Johnson Richardson,
the dismissal is without prejudice. Why wouldn't you have that just from the without prejudice?
I suppose I could have refiled and started the whole process again, but I also immediately took leave of appeal and well now we're here. And again, in Johnson Richardson, that court found after two attempts of service of process based on the mailings issue that has been at issue in this case, that plaintiff had not mailed it to an agent authorized to receive service. And that plaintiff was given another opportunity to effect service. So if we're going to rely on Johnson and Richardson, which again, my position is that the several other cases that, you know, uncontroversially accept that a plaintiff can serve through the mail is my preference. But if we're going to rely on Johnson Richardson, then as a similarly situated plaintiff, I should also be given a third opportunity on remand to effect service. And I can affirm and swear to this court that I will hire a professional process server so we won't be in this same territory again.
No. I have a question about standing. Georgetown argues you don't have standing. And I just want to make sure I understand your theory of it. Is it essentially that this grade is going to harm your future job prospects? And that's the injury that you're trying to remedy?
Correct, Your Honor. The harm is this illegitimate grade on my transcript. And every time that I apply for a job, I'm asked to declare my GPA, and they ask for a copy of my transcript. So this is an ongoing violation. There's continuing harm. Unfortunately, as lawyers, our law school GPAs do end up determining a large part of our professional opportunities.
This may not end up being important, but we don't know which direction you think your GPA would change if this was changed to a pass, but we don't know from the papers and we don't know how much. Do you know how much your GPA would change?
Okay, I don't want to get in trouble by offering facts to the court that are not already contained in the record. But yes, I've recalculated my GPA, and it would have been the difference between graduating cum laude and not, which is very significant. For example, federal clerkships many times have as a requirement that an applicant must have graduated at least with cum laude. And so any time that I look at any sort of job posting, I'm left out of an entire category of opportunities due to this illegitimate grade on my transcript that ended up being outcome determinative for whether I received honors or not. As regards the district court's finding that I failed to state a claim, first, the district court improperly construed the facts in a light actually most favorable to the defendant and not the-
Running into your red light. I'll give you a minute.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Do that.
First of all, I would state that that it demonstrates an inherent bias that infects the entire legal reasoning. The district court said that I turned in a subpar paper and received a poor grade. That's not even something that Georgetown has stated in any of their filings. It's something that the district court completely made up. And it's an adverse, one, it violates construing the facts the light most reasonable to me. But it's evidence of judicial bias in that this order is based on facts that they completely made up. And again, my view of my legal claim is that I was otherwise discriminated against because I raised an issue about whether professors fulfilled their minimum requirements under the rules of Georgetown. And in deciding that issue, which was unrelated to my modest extension in a paper, Georgetown decided to excuse their professor's failure to meet their minimum requirements.
Thank you. We'll give you some rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Schuster, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Stephanie Schuster here on behalf of Georgetown. I want to pick off where plaintiff left off on the notion of judicial bias. I think the record shows the district court. Plaintiff fairly and reasonably. The lawsuit is properly dismissed because it was procedurally and substantively defective in at least three ways, starting with service, Judge Katsas. Plaintiff failed to properly serve Georgetown despite getting a second opportunity to do so. Both times, he attempted service himself, contrary to both the federal rules and DC law. And both times, plaintiffs failed to direct the papers to a person authorized to accept service on Georgetown's behalf and consequently failed to produce proof.
On the first point, your first ground of insufficient service, why isn't it enough for him to hand it to a friend who put it in the mail? I mean, this rule that you can't self-serve by mail is ridiculous enough to begin with. And he has a friend do it. So
certainly, Your Honor, if he'd had a friend, if the district court had found that his friend had actually deposited the envelope in the mail, that would be effective service in our
an
view.
Affidavit.
The yeah, but the
submitted the affidavit.
The affidavit is very clear. The person who signed it.
The only question is whether the friend putting the papers in the mail is rendered invalid because he wrote out the address and the return address.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. I think that's inconsistent with the district court's findings. What the district court found is that it wasn't clear from the face of the affidavit. And if you look at the affidavit, the person who signed it does not attest that she served it. She did not say, I delivered these papers. There are several boxes to check where a process server can check. I served, I left, I returned the summons. That wasn't done here.
Counsel, I'm just reading from footnote in the district court opinion. He had a third party deliver his complaint and summons to the U.S. Postal Service. I don't see it any time when he says the affidavit is unclear.
I'll point you to it, Your Honor, if you bear with me for just one second. He says the affidavit, the attachments to the proof of service are not exactly clear as to who submitted the package. Bottom of page, it's on 97 of the appendix, page 5 of the opinion. The exhibits attached to his proof of service do not clearly indicate who physically submitted the package complaint to the U.S. Postal Service for delivery. And if you look at the affidavit of service, it says, where she checked other, she says, in the passive voice, sent by certified mail. The district court had that, and it had the evidence of the envelope, which says from the plaintiff. Plaintiff had an opportunity to submit additional evidence. He didn't. But based on the evidence in the record, the district court's conclusion that plaintiff served is not clearly erroneous, and its decision to dismiss rather than give plaintiff a third chance at the apple, a third bite at the apple, was not an abuse of discretion. But even putting aside who sent the papers, we have the other deficiency that the papers were not directed to an appropriate person authorized to accept service. Again, the federal rules and DC law require entities to be served via a registered agent or a person authorized to accept service.
Who's the appropriate person?
The registered agent, I believe, is
the general counsel.
CT Corp. The general counsel is, I mean, at Georgetown University's general counsel is a vice president, and
is the law school separately incorporated?
I believe it is, but
the law school has its own.
The law school does not have its own general counsel. The Georgetown University's Office of General Counsel is the office of general counsel.
That would seem to be the right person.
It could be if it was delivered to them, but the Office of the General Counsel, from a simple Google search, is not located at the law school. There is no Georgetown Law General Counsel. The
problem was it went to New Jersey Ave rather than cross the river in Georgetown.
Correct. It was not directed to the appropriate office or to the appropriate person. And that's why there's no return receipt showing it was received by the Office of the General Counsel. Effective service is essential to personal jurisdiction, and for good reason. If you look at what happened in this case, the first misdirected service, not directed to an authorized person, resulted in entry of default against Georgetown. That's when Georgetown learned about this lawsuit. These aren't mere technicalities. These are essential requirements to personal jurisdiction. And as this court has made clear, courts have uniformly held that any judgment rendered in a case where service does not comply with the effective service requirements is invalid.
I'm sorry, who did you say he should have served?
He could have served the Office of the General Counsel at its address, because that individual whose name is not placed in these papers is an officer of Georgetown University. Under the rules, an officer of an entity or another person legally authorized to accept service, like a registered agent, would have been appropriate. Georgetown also has a registered agent. But even putting the service issues aside and turning quickly to standing, plaintiff lacks standing because he seeks only declaratory and injunctive relief, both of which are forms of relief that require either an ongoing injury or an imminent future injury. Plaintiff has asserted in his reply brief and then here again today that his grade being permanent on his transcript might harm unspecified job prospects. The complaint doesn't support that theory. It's not alleged.
I mean, why wouldn't Mr. Skuzcox have standing to have his grade petition reviewed without animus?
Well,
I mean, it's a kind of procedural harm, arguably, under the Rehabilitation Act.
Certainly, but he does not have the sort of injury in fact necessary to have the grade petition reviewed. He does not have an ongoing injury that supports giving the court jurisdiction.
That?
Because he does not
need, it's a little bit abstract, but we look to harms analogous to common law, defamation, FCRA cases. If you have adverse information in your credit report, maybe it harms you going forward with some future application, maybe it doesn't, but that is not too abstract an injury for Article III purposes.
I do think it's too abstract an injury for Article III purposes. It's not concrete. He's not alleged. It's pure speculation based on the assertions, which again are unalleged, not in the complaint, but based on the assertions in his brief in here today.
He's
speculated about it. The Article III requires plausible allegations at this stage of a concrete, particularized, and either actual or imminent injury.
I didn't go back and reread Spokio, so I'm doing this from memory, but there was a distinction between information like the person has the wrong zip code versus information that, you know, the person is a tax cheat or something. And that's a bad grade seems more like the latter.
Right. A concrete injury needs to have a real world. We're talking about concreteness at this point rather than whether it's ongoing. It was what Spokio was about. But in terms of it being concrete, it need to have a real world impact. You need to allege some real world effect that actually resulted in negative impact.
We're all lawyers. We all know that law school GPAs matter for job prospects.
Certainly. GPAs matter for all sorts of job prospects, Your Honor. But the plaintiff has not alleged a single instance where he attempted to get a job and was denied.
But does he have to allege that in order to show that he is standing for what's a sort of procedural harm to have his grade reviewed without animus?
He does. He needs to allege an ongoing harm that affects him in a real way for the court to
the harm
order
is that
relief.
His allegation is that his grade was reviewed, with bias. And so if it were reviewed without bias, the outcome may be different. And in that kind of procedural harm, ordinarily causation and redressability is somewhat relaxed. He doesn't have to show that his grade would definitely change or that it would change, you know, in a certain direction.
And the definiteness of the change is not our argument, but he does need to show that the injury is ongoing. A past injury is not enough to make out a present case or controversy for a plaintiff seeking the type of injunctive or declaratory relief that he's seeking. But moving to the point of animus, I see my time's about to expire. So let me turn to the final grounds. Putting aside lack of personal jurisdiction, defective service, lack of standing, the plaintiff also fails to state a claim. Whether it's construed as a failure to accommodate claim or a disparate treatment claim based on animus, plaintiff doesn't plausibly allege that his grade change was denied because of or by reason of his disability. He never requested that Georgetown extend the deadline for him to submit his final paper, even though he sought and was granted an extension of the interim deadline to submit the draft for feedback. Plaintiff challenged his grade because, as a result, he had less time for feedback. The complaint doesn't plausibly allege that Georgetown denied that challenge because of the fact that he requested an accommodation. The complaint makes clear Georgetown denied the allegation because plaintiff chose this truncated review period and then complained about it after the fact. Plaintiff's choice to seek that extension defeats this disparate treatment claim or an animus claim in two ways. One, breaks the causal chain necessary to make out that claim. But another, it demonstrates that on the face of the complaint, there is an obvious alternative explanation to any insinuation of animus that is now being argued on appeal, that this was plaintiff's choice. He asked for this. He did not. He had options available to him and did not exercise them. I see my time's about to expire. So unless the court has questions, for these reasons, we'd ask that the judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Skuzcox, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you. On rebuttal, I would like to draw the court's attention to the proof of service affidavit found on page 35 of the joint appendix. To parse the language, Georgetown has said that, again, I delivered it the second time. We have this affidavit signed under a penalty of perjury, and just reading through the text here, it says, this summons for Georgetown University Law Center was received by me, referring to the third party, on April 6, 2023. And then she checks the box and says, sent by certified mail. If we look at the I is not there. But if we look at the context of this, it's saying received by me and sent on by certified mail, blah, blah, blah. So the context here is clear that it was she, there's a missing I here, but the context is clear that it was her who sent it. And again, I mean, if Georgetown's position here is that service was defective now because there was an pronoun I missing after the pronoun me, I mean, I think that stretches all reasonability. And given the fact that, again, I'm a pro se plaintiff here, working with a third party to effect service, I mean, it's just unreasonable. And the grammatical context here is clear that it was sent by her. To conclude, even if this court agrees with Georgetown that for one of these reasons, services, even if the court agrees that, for example, plaintiffs are prohibited from filling out a return address field and that should trump an affidavit signed under the penalty of perjury, I should get another opportunity to effect service. Even if the court agrees that I lack standing or that there was a failure to state a claim, again, I would ask that this court grant me leave on remand to amend the complaint to comply with these standards as is custom under Rule 15.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. The case is submitted.